Welcome back to MERS Monday, for more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. Today on MERS Monday, Michael Stroud of Republican Nikki Snyder's U.S. Senate campaign and Thomas Norton, past president of the Michigan Conservative Union, share their experiences at the Mackinac Republican Leadership Conference. State Rep. Karen Whitsitt of Detroit explains why she voted against several bills creating a Reproductive Health Act in Michigan. And CEO Daniel Hurley of the Michigan Association of State Universities and Robert Davies, president of Central Michigan University, explain why 10 public universities are guaranteeing admission to high school seniors with at least a 3-point GPA. Now here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, and MERS House reporter Danielle James.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast and previewing the miscellaneous interviews we have for you all. However, I must disclose that I say fire up twice while interviewing Central Michigan University's president, Robert Davies, today. But Kyle, Danny, I feel like with all of the MSU merchandise I am forced to look at each time I walk into the MERS World headquarters, I deserve some CMU treats, don't I?
Bring it in. You can put your Central Michigan stuff up.
Okay, I have a
banner. I just don't have any personally.
I have a banner that's on its way, Kyle. I'm going to take you up on that offer. But to begin today's segment, we are zooming in on this past weekend's Mackinac Republican Leadership Conference, which has been taking place biannually since 1943. Here to talk about the event and the changing dynamics of the state GOP are Michael Stroud, who works in political campaign management and fundraising, and Tom Norton, the Midwest director of the America First PAC. Thank you all so much for joining us on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast and also sharing what your experience was like on the island this past weekend. Again, we are also joined by Danielle James, our House reporter, who was also on the ground on the island this past weekend. And the question that I have for each of you, in three words, how would you describe this year's Mackinac Republican Leadership Conference and why? And I'll start off with you, Michael. How would you describe how this past weekend went down?
Yeah, so the three words I have written down here are young, diverse, and new. For the first time in a couple of years, we've seen and I've been coming to Mackinac since 2009. There was a little bit of a drop in like young people, college Republican attendance. That was not true this year. I know the Nikki Snyder campaign brought up about 40 college Republicans. I know there was college Republicans up for a couple of other efforts. So really to see the young people back engaged was awesome. Diverse. There was a ton of ethnic and racial diversity at the conference, which, again, dating back like 2011, we definitely didn't see that. We've seen it grow and grow. There was more Indian American representation. There was more Muslim representation. There's more African-American representation than I have ever seen at one of these Mackinac conferences before. And new, there was a lot of new people, people that have been getting involved in the last, you know, post 2016. And that's kind of, again, that's kind of always true, but I would say, you know, disproportionately true this year.
But I think it was an absolute financial failure. And the reason I can say this is, I was to a Mackinac conference about 8 years ago. I got a lot of friends that go all the time. And when you walk up on the front deck, it's usually packed with people. You walk on the inside of the Mackinac Hotel, it's packed with people. Then you walk into the room, it's constantly packed. You look at the pictures of it, that didn't happen at all. It was more diverse. You did have some young people in there. But when you don't have anybody there, it's going to look a lot more diverse. The cheapest hotel I've ever seen on the Mackinac side, like crossing the ferry, off the island, the week of the conference is usually $200-$300 for the weekend. I was able to stay there for like $92. That's how you know it wasn't good, is that you could still get a room on the island Friday, Saturday day at the Harbor Inn, a lot of the other hotels and things of that nature all the way around there too. I mean, that's signs that it's not financially secure. The event costs almost $300,000. It usually brings in almost $1 million to the Republican Party. It's very clear that remotely did not happen. And I got a feeling that we are in a much larger financial bind than in years past. And a lot of the diversity that is coming in isn't a byproduct of the leadership there. It's a byproduct of the woke culture across the United States shoving these people into our group anyway. And there's a lot of opportunity there, but we're really failing to be able to take advantage of it because we're not going to have any money to advertise.
You know, Tom, now that you bring that up, I am curious. Do you think it was an embarrassment to host it? Do you think it would have been better off just not having it to begin with?
No, well, she had claimed in May at the state committee meetings. This is why she doesn't allow committee, you know, or June. And in past meetings for the state committee, she doesn't like recordings there because, well, she says stuff and then she can't deliver. She said that this was going to be the most successful conference we ever saw. We were going to make a lot of money on it. A lot of promises in state committee meetings. And then when pointedly asked during the state committee meeting, because I was in there during it about it, they sit there and dodged the question of how much money the event made.
And when you're talking about she, you're talking about Chair Christina Caramo, correct?
And Chair Caramo and her budget director, both of them, they were definitely back and forth on that and on trying to hide where the money situation is. They've been hiding that since day one, which is a very concerning item.
What three words would you use, Danny?
Yeah, and so I want to kind of preface that I know the theme of this conference was sort of getting back to constitutional roots, but I think there were also, you know, quite a few other topics that I saw really poke through. And I sort of focused on some F words. Faith and fraud were the two that I saw. Faith being, you know, a need to return back to roots of not theocracy, but putting, I guess, God back into politics was a common theme across a lot of the speakers. And then election fraud was something that we saw people get really riled up about, especially when Kari Lake was speaking. And it seemed like that was a topic that people got really excited about and wanted to hear more about. And, you know, we're still talking about, even though it's been a few cycles since that was first introduced. And then the third word I wanted to use is fluid, because one of the things that I noticed was a lot of change going on during the event. Things like, you know, new speakers being introduced, people being moved around, a lot of schedule changes, which, you know, I feel like can be expected with new leadership and kind of trying to host a different type of event. But that was one of the things that really stood out to me.
I also want to ask, because a big thing about this conference is the presidential straw poll, where obviously former President Donald Trump won with 402 votes and Vivek Ramaswamy followed behind with, I believe, less than 70 in the straw poll. Based on conversations circulating during this year's conference, is there a scenario in any universe where President Donald Trump does not win a presidential primary in Michigan by an anticipated landslide? I ask this especially after the state committee approved a plan for 39 of Michigan's 55 national delegates to be awarded in closed congressional district conventions. What are your thoughts on this, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I do think he's going to, as it stands today, he would be absolutely the winner of the primary. I think there's a lot to happen between now and then. I think we've seen that happen a number of times. So I don't want to say that'll be true. I don't see a path necessarily for someone to beat him at this moment, just both nationally and in the early states. We also don't know who's going to still be on the ballot by the time it gets here. With all that being said, Vivek Ramaswamy is a very fascinating character in the pros that he is the next kind of Trump energy, right? So he brings this very disruptor energy to the stage and gets people fired up with a very similar energy to former President Trump. I think Vivek has kind of threaded the needle of both going after this woke wokeness. I mean, that's his book, right? That's kind of what he was famous for prior to running for president. And it's also, he brings that energy to the stage. He did a great job. He had a great event on Friday night. And that's always kind of a hallmark of a successful Mackinac is being able to bring that energy and set the island a little bit of buzz about your candidacy. And I think he and Nikki Snyder kind of had the most energy up on the island.
But Nikki Snyder wasn't actually on the island. She just had her young volunteers there.
No, she was on the island the whole time.
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
Yes. Yeah. Nikki, she was not a speaker, but she was on the island the entire time, mostly on Main Street, meeting with candidates for other offices, donors, grassroots organizers, kind of anybody that was wanted to be heard, wanted their opinion heard. She was meeting with them.
Who did you see as having a real strong presence on the island as far as future or current political candidates?
Well, I know a lot of them that are current office holders. I saw Nikki there, known Nikki for years. I believe Hoover made a slight appearance there as well. So I've seen both of them. I did see Peter Meyer. He got to hold the baby. Contradictory popular belief, we are personal friends, even though we have massive political differences. So he was up there as well. So, I mean, there's quite a few. I found it interesting that Meyer ended up going to the conference on there. And I saw a couple other people, and they're like, you know, a lot of the old timers I saw there would have come to show up to support the party no matter who the leadership is, because the Republicans that believe in supporting the party itself. But that's what I saw.
Did you see Mike Rogers there?
I did not.
I heard that he was there on Friday.
I may have missed him, but I mean, I was ended up hanging out with a lot of other different people on Friday night. I actually went ahead and crossed the boat back over, hung out with some friends of mine that live in northern Michigan that I hadn't seen in a couple of years. So that they're Republicans, but they don't tend to go to the conference. They're not that involved yet.
So Rogers kind of blew in and blew out, didn't he, Danny?
Yes, he was there on Friday. Nobody really saw him around except for when he was leaving. There were a few of us that caught him, and he didn't seem interested in, I don't want to say making too public his presence, but he wasn't doing any media availability.
I wonder who he ended up meeting with. He didn't say, huh?
Mm-mm, no.
Was there anyone that either of you saw that you were genuinely surprised by?
No. I mean, like I said, the attendance was significantly lower than past years. So, no. And a lot of them, I mean, I know a lot of the faces because I've been involved with the grassroots for so long that I know a lot of them. And when I was talking to them, I told them, listen, this is how big it used to be. They'd never been to the conference before. And I was like, I certainly you guys enjoyed the speakers. Heck, I would have probably liked a good chunk of the speakers as well on there if I had time to go in there and sit down with them, because they're helping another guy that's going to run for mayor of a big city in Michigan here shortly. And when you're going through and you're not seeing as many people, you're going to see people who are more diehards, more activists, like more grassroots. But the other problem is a lot of these people, they just spend all their political money for the year on helping candidates or helping the party because of the hotels and stuff like that, just because of the income levels of them. They are working class. So, I mean, we've done the Mackinac Conference for years, but thinking about it a little bit more to the first point on there, it may have been more advantageous for Ms. Cromwell just to move the entire thing to a location where these folks could have afforded a little bit more. Then maybe you could have turned out a little bit more of your base to it, because she's just not appealing to donors.
Hey, real quick, I wanted to get this question. Tom, what's the odds on a scale of 1 to 10 that Peter Meyer runs for U.S. Senate?
I'd put it, just from some of the conversations on there, I'd put him probably 70%, knowing him personally on there. I'd put it at 70%, because when he was in the House, even though we were running against each other, there's occasions he'd call me on bills and he'd actually ask me my opinion on him before he went and voted. And sometimes you could gauge him. He collects information before he makes decisions. I mean, obviously he makes some bad decisions on many occasions, but he does take the information. He wants to make sure that he's not violating his beliefs before he takes a vote. And that's one of the reasons I respect him. I can disagree with him wholeheartedly, but every vote he takes, he tries to make sure that he can sleep with himself at night. So that's the part. So with the decision he's making right now with the new baby and everything else, I'd probably put it at about 70%.
Based off of the energy right now on the island, and I think I specifically want to think about the U.S. Senate race, do you think that there's any chance of any new candidates getting in, or do you think this is very much the slate that we have on the Republican side?
Well, we have 13 candidates running in from the grassroots base, or 8 or 9 or something like that. I mean, we got an entire baseball team like we had for governor, but I think it's going to reduce to 5 Trump-style candidates on the ballot. That's what I think it's going to reduce to. And then you'll probably have Rogers and Meyer. That's the odds. I think you'll have 7 total that will make the ballot. Because when you look at the list, look how many have exploratory committees. But there are 3 or 4 really trying to actually organize and push to run from that Trump base. So it will be an interesting primary on there, because it will be excessively divided. The thing is, I tried to explain this because I'm more in the Trump wing of the party by far. I definitely am more in that wing. But I also realize that the majority of society is not necessarily in line with me on certain issues or in certain districts. And I've explained that to even grassroots conservatives. I said, listen, you have to appeal to a broader base. So it's interesting how people think, vote, and they say they'll never do something, and then they end up doing it, especially when it comes to voting. So, but I don't see any other candidates outside of everybody with an exploratory committee actually running. I believe that Karamo was looking at it. And I mean, with the pushback she's having, I think even her team is has backed off from any of those types of speculation.
The state party chair running for U.S. Senate, like, come on. I mean...
Michael, you've been paying attention, obviously, because you've been working with Nikki Snyder. What about James Craig? Did he have any presence at all on the island that you saw?
No. James Craig had no presence. Again, the only people who had any sort of real presence were the only people that have any real money in the race at this point, or in time in the race and relationships in the race. And again, you know, kind of it's interesting, people, you know, I don't know if Tom's including Nikki in the kind of the Trump wing of the party. She does have broader appeal, right? I mean, she's been fighting on issues that aren't Trump specific and has a, you know, proven track record on them. I think the nice thing about, you know, candidates that do have broad appeal is that someone like Nikki Snyder can really talk about issues that not just Republican primary voters are passionate about, but the general electorate actually, by, you know, polls continue to show us, are winning issues for us. So I think you're going to see some consolidation ultimately, right? I mean, you're going to see a moment where it seems like we have a million candidates in the race. Maybe that's the moment we're in right now. I don't think that moment's going to last forever. I think it's going to shrink. Ultimately, I don't know if that number is 5 plus 2. I don't know if it's 3 plus 2, whatever it ends up being, in terms of people that actually get the signatures necessary to get on the ballot and have any money to actually campaign. You know, I think that number is probably less than 7.
Michael, a question that I have for you is someone who actually, you know, works in elections and works of campaign management. Do you think that this conference missed an opportunity to talk about elections? I know that Danielle mentioned faith and fraud, but could there have been deeper conversations about how to mobilize people and how to set up a strategy for winning in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's ultimately, look, the truth of the matter is Michigan has disproportionately had a strong party for a long time. We've been spoiled. Okay. We've had party leadership that has been not just state leaders, but national leaders in terms of their ability to fundraise and build a state party infrastructure. It's incumbent upon candidates to do that. It's incumbent upon them to do that now moving forward. That's how it should be. That's how it is in lots of other states. So has that ever really happened at these things? I don't know. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders giving a speech, which happened previous Mackinac, I don't know that that was more about how we could win, right? I don't know that. It's not like we had come off of a big winning streak prior to that Mackinac either, right? I don't know that Mackinac is typically different from talks of ideology or speeches from famous people, right? I mean, I think that's kind of what it is in the room, right? But to me, Mackinac is not what happens in the room. It's not what happens on that stage. I know that's what the media covers because that's where they can actually get people, you know, to talk, but it's what happens in the rooms, right? AFP had a great event. Sonny Reddy, who's running for Wayne State, had a great event. Vivek Ramaswamy had a great event. Nikki Snyder had great people up there, a lot of great energy, good meetings. Like, what? It's not what happens in the grand on the stage that makes Mackinac. It's what happens on the porch, in the bars and restaurants, on Main Street. That's where the importance of Mackinac is. And yes, it was smaller for sure. Yes, there was less of those conversations for sure. But the ones that were had are still important and still bring value to winning in 24.
The thing about Mackinac, the guy that mentored me a lot in the politics and convention floor races, actually, we helped a lot, was Norm Hughes electing Nikki Slater to the State Board of Education. That was like one of his big ones that he was involved in last before he passed away. But what he always described Mackinac as was the greatest networking opportunity in the state of Michigan in setting up the ability for us to bring in new donors. That's why that was a financial failure this weekend. But he is right that there is still good events and good parties and good opportunity for networking around the island.
Tom, I know that you talked a bit about these financial frustrations geared toward Chair Karamo. What is the level of morale right now among grassroots Republicans?
There's a massive split, and it's getting worse that she's not being transparent. I mean, when she campaigned, and I was very involved in that convention for Fight For Her because I'm close with Melinda Pago, that she was going to be this most transparent chair in history. There's videos of her promising to raise $50 million. There's no way possible for her to do that. And I mean, she's walked away from big donors. She doesn't think she needs their money. She thinks that we can win without donor money. And then during her campaign, she was complaining for a lack of support from the party. So it's very hypocritical that her messaging is all over the place all the time now. I can tell you that from when I hopped on her campaign to help her in the convention floor fight, I ran the day of convention floor fight. People saw me running around with my suit on, actually doing that and organizing it. And the promises made about how she was going to operate this party were drastically blatant lies. So that's where I have a disconnect with her drastically. There's a little bit more to that. I covered it with Kyle a while back. So the party is getting very demoralized because they are seeing this financial woes. And there are good, solid grassroots conservatives, a lot of major Trump people, that realize you need money to run elections. 75% of the base are very intelligent, hardworking, middle-class Americans that really bust their hind end. They understand that money's necessary in politics. They donate $25. These Trump folks go out and knock doors and they bust their hind end, and there's a lot of value to the party there. But even they realize that you need the money. And then you got this small 25% wing. I don't think if the chair race was held today that she'd have a remote chance of winning dog catcher in the Republican Party at this moment. But you have this small 25% hardcore base that don't think you need money. They don't think you need doors. They believe that only prayer is necessary to win an election. And prayer is important. I go to church. My kids are baptized. We do that. Prayer is very important for guidance. But I mean, the Bible even says faith without works is dead. So they're reading all the faith stuff, but they don't want to put in the work. So, and that's where this problem's coming in on that split that's happening in the base. There's those who want to do something and don't have direction. And then there's those who don't want to do anything but complain. I mean, we have a chair that's in charge that screams unity and then turns around and tears down her own people. That's concerning. Where she's at right now, she could still turn it around. She could, but she'd have to open up the books, be transparent and say, hey, I'm not raising the money. And then what she would have to do from there is turn around and say, listen, I'm having issues raising the money. Who here is willing to help me? And if she did that, she could still become effective. It's just she's running out of time. And I think pride is getting in the way. So there's plenty of people who have approached her to offer her help financially, from Lena Epstein to Scott Greenlee. I set up meetings in D.C. for her with donors. So she's been rejecting the help. But if she came back to Lena or Greenlee or even myself, we might try to set up the meetings one more time or maybe get her in the direction she needs to help her. This is about the Republican Party, but instead we're going into this very massive purity test. And that's what's creating these problems and the divisions in the base of the party, because like I said, there's 75% of these of Trump folks that see we need money. There is nobody in their right mind in politics that doesn't think you don't need to actually donate.
I do just have, we are over time here, but I do just want to ask kind of a final question about the $20,000 charge, the conversations around that's circulating. In order to appear on the Republican presidential ballot for these closed caucuses, you're going to have to pay $20,000 to get on.
Yes.
Is there a truth to that? And is that...
Nope, it's passed. She passed it. It was a very close vote, but they passed it. And the thing is, it's going to be another Karamo classic because she's not going to reach out for help for funding this convention. So it's just going to be another Karamo classic failure.
Now, other states do a lot of closed caucus primaries. Now, is this something that is kind of out of the ordinary, or is this something that
no,
you would be able...
No.
Okay.
No, they do it in South Carolina. There's other states that do it. So that is correct. But here's the thing. Michigan's not North. It's not Iowa. It's not North Carolina. It's not South Carolina. It's not Nevada. We are the fifth state in that primary process. Okay. And the fee is due 5 days after the Iowa caucus. So what's going to end up happening, we're going to do this caucus for the delegates. We're already going to know who the nominee is, and people are going to have to drive to Detroit, pay $50 to $150 a piece to pay for this convention center. By the time it's all said and done, this is what's going to happen. It's going to be $50 to $100 a piece, and they're going to have to pay for hotels to walk in and hand Donald Trump the rest of the delegates. That's what's going to end up happening, because these candidates are going to be dropping out after Iowa. I'm sorry. They're running for cabinet positions, most of these folks. Vivek's running for a cabinet position or vice president. You got the same thing with Nikki Haley. You got the same thing with all of them. I mean, Mike Pence is only running because, well, they had a disagreement over January 6th. That's more out of spite. But he's not. After Iowa, most of these people are dropping out the following day. So they're going to file the application. They're going to do all of it. And then they're just not going to pay the $20,000 because they know they're going to be dropping out on caucus 4 days later. So the money's due 4 days later. They'll just take care of it after that. That's what's going to end up happening. So if we were an earlier state, let's say Iowa, Michigan, New Hampshire. Oh, my gosh, we'd be golden. Everybody would be paying for it. These delegates wouldn't have to pay for the convention. But they're trying to say that the delegates aren't going to have to pay. And they're going to have to. The math just isn't there.
And unfortunately, we are out of time, but I appreciate you all participating on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Again, that is Michael Stroud, a political campaign management and fundraising professional, and Tom Norton, the Midwest director of the American First PAC. Thank you all so much for taking the time to join us on the MERS Monday podcast. Joining us for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast is State Representative Karen Whitsitt, a Detroit Democrat, who has recently found herself in headlines for voting against her Democratic colleague's Reproductive Health Act legislation in the House Health Policy Committee. While part of this package was voted out of committee on September 20th, ultimately, the Reproductive Health Act, RHA, legislation would remove Michigan's ban on Medicaid reimbursement for abortion care, would eliminate the 24-hour waiting period before someone can obtain an abortion, would lift the separate rider mandate for those seeking abortion coverage from their private insurance, and would repeal various criminal charges against physicians for things like aborting a moving fetus and performing abortion services following fetal viability. Now, Representative Whitsitt, going into that committee hearing, going in to take that vote, what all was going through your head? And when did you genuinely make your mind on how you were going to vote on this?
What was genuinely going through my head is reflecting on my own situation of being a rape victim and having had a termination myself and what we're talking about with this legislation. I went through the 24-hour waiting period. I took that pause just to ensure that that was the right decision for me during my situation, during my time. And yes, that is a very personal decision to make. And with this package, there are a lot of things that are in here. Some things are just common sense that need to come out. Of course, I want to make sure that there are no criminal charges for doctors for performing abortions. And let's just be clear, I'm not against RHA. But I am there wanting to make sure that there are guardrails that are in place that ensure that we're making the proper decision. That's what's important to me, because once we undo this, we can't go back. For example, like I'm referring to the 24-hour period. I do not see anything wrong with 24 hours to take that pause to ensure that you're making the right decision. If I went online and I filled out that form at 9 a.m., my appointment could be 10 a.m. tomorrow. I don't see what the problem is with that 24 hour. Now, do we want to bring that up to 2023? Yes, let's do that. Let's make it a DocuSign. That's perfectly a legit thing to do to be able to get that on board with being in 2023. You know, do I want to make sure that the clinics are safe? I have not been shown within our legislation to this date, if the things that we're talking about removing, when it comes down to the structure of the abortion clinics to ensure that they're going to remain safe, has not been shown to me. I need to see that that is already there. I am a Black woman in the city of Detroit, one of the poorest communities. Who do you think is going to be affected the most by this? Like I said, once it's undone, there's no going back. And what are we going to do? Look back 10 years later when we have a lot of people who have lost their lives because these places were not kept up to the standards that they should be because I undid something? That's not something I'm willing to live with. And I do not think it's too much to ask to ensure that we're making the right decisions.
I do want to ask, in this past week, have any of your colleagues, anyone with Planned Parenthood of Michigan, come to you to make a compelling case? Or has it all just been bashing right now?
I have plenty of colleagues that are actually feeling the same way I do. They are not in support of Medicaid-funded abortions. Of course, we're in support of incest, rape, life and death of the mother. Of course, we're in support of that. But when you're talking about currently, based on the current numbers, $2 million being spent, and if we make that where it's elected abortions, then we're talking $6 million. I would like to better see that money spent when we're talking about things that could be addressed, like I've said, as far as seniors. They're receiving $20 to $40 as far as an EBT card is concerned. I would love to see them receive $80 to $100. I would love to see where Medicaid funding is going towards mental health. Wouldn't it be awesome if we could have people phone in for telehealth to be able to get that assistance, especially when you're talking about a termination? These are things that we can actually do with these dollars that make sense, that helps everyone.
I know you talked a little bit about some other members who may have hold us as well, but you know, what has been the response from the majority of the caucus?
Well, these were conversations that were being had before we got to that vote. I will be honest, I felt as if my back was up against the wall because the bills were moving and I had not received the answers that I needed to feel comfortable with the vote. And I just want to see that. And like I said, I'm not the only person. There are several of us that are in the same boat, that feel the same way, and we're asking the same questions, and we were in the room together asking those questions the night before that vote. I am just the one that's on the committee that took the vote. But if it came to the floor, the votes are not there.
I heard you say on WJR that there's seven of you, seven Democrats, who cannot support Medicaid-funded abortions. Is that still the number that you know of?
We have not gotten back together and met up. But last conversation before I took the vote, that's where we were at.
And as part of the package, there is a piece that allows for abortion past the time of fetal viability. Is that something you have a position on one way or the other?
Like I say, I don't want to get into those things because I need to be more informed about it. And this goes back to the questions that are being asked. I need to be able to make an informed decision. You know, I need to be able to be comfortable with that. And like I said, I'm not just talking about myself personally. I'm talking about the people that I'm representing. And when I'm out here in the community and I'm having these conversations, this is what's being asked of me. So people think that it may be difficult for me to stand up and to have taken that vote. No, actually it's not at all. Because these are the things that people are asking. They have questions and they want answers to those questions. And that's my job. That is my job to make sure that I find those answers. Because like I said, once it's done, we can't undo it.
I want to ask, how do Detroit voters or Detroiters overall really feel about the subject of abortion? Because I know that that was something talked about in 2022, that Proposal 3 isn't going to mobilize new Detroit voters to the poll. And I look at it right here. Proposal 3 won in Detroit by over 66,000 votes. But again, mm-hmm. This is out of a city that has over 600,000 residents. Could you shine a light about how the issue of abortion is talked about in Detroit households?
As far as the conversations that I've heard, people are in support of ensuring that there are safe and accessible abortions, especially when we're talking about birth control, reproductive health. That is extremely important. That is across the board that has been there, even with conservatives. Even when they don't agree with abortion itself, they do agree with it being safe and accessible. But when it comes down to Medicaid-funded abortions, that's where people have drawn the line at with me. That was not something that we agreed upon when it came upon Prop 3 when we were having that conversation. And I don't see how we're having that conversation now.
And you personally supported Proposal 3, correct?
Absolutely. Like I say, I have been raped. I've gone through a termination. There is absolutely no way I'm going to stand in the way of someone making a decision for themselves. I'm absolutely not going to do that.
And how does that make you feel to have been a sexual violence survivor, to have gone through the abortion process, the 24-hour waiting period, and to now see groups like Planned Parenthood Advocates of Michigan put flyers out of you?
I can't even actually believe it. And I actually went out with Planned Parenthood and I actually did have these conversations and told my story. So to villainize me is utterly ridiculous because I'm not a sheep. Because I don't just follow along because I'm a Democrat, because I actually am a representative that represents my district. And they asked me to ask the tough questions, and that's what I'm doing. I'm going to do my job to the best of my ability. And I'm going to always do that. And I'm not a sheep, and I'm not just going to follow along. I'm going to make sure that I represent the people of my district. And everyone with these questions that I'm asking, these are their concerns. And I'm getting them addressed one way or another. And Planned Parenthood has no right to villainize me in any way, shape, or form, especially someone who is a rape victim. You know, that's ridiculous to me that you would even take it upon yourself to put that information out there and to be so false. Like I said, it's my job to represent and make sure Black women, women of color, are not the ones who end up at the bottom when it comes down to this issue. And I'm not going to just sit back and not do anything.
And, you know, House Democratic spokesperson Amber McCann and some of the other health policy members kind of spoke about how they believe conversations can be had to, you know, change your mind. Do you think the caucus would be willing to make some of those changes and address some of those concerns you've talked about to get you back on board?
I think they absolutely should be. I mean, like I say, this is not Karen Whitsett having this conversation. This is the person who's representing District 4 having this conversation, and I deserve that respect. Because right now, what you're telling me is what the people in my district are saying doesn't matter, that they're just supposed to go along and get along, and that you feel that attacking me in some way, shapes, or form justifies the things that you're saying. It doesn't. It doesn't. Not at all. And that's not the way to try to work together. Why is it that I don't get to question? Am I just supposed to go along with whatever the Democratic Party rubber stamps? That's not something I've ever done since I've been elected, and I'm definitely not about to start on this issue, something this important.
Representative, you had a very strong relationship with the former House Speaker, Jason Wentworth. How is your relationship with the House Minority Leader, Matt Hall?
I would not say that we've actually ever built a relationship.
Okay.
You know, we are aware of who each other are. We haven't had much reason to have much of a conversation. My relationship with Speaker Tate is amazing. We have a great working relationship as well as a friendship. But no, haven't really had much of a reason to have conversations with the minority leader.
Well, and the reason I ask is because I know that you're very passionate about the mayor and his tax plan and trying mm-hmm. to get some property tax relief for residents in your city. And I was just trying to test the waters here on if you've had conversations with Republicans on supporting this proposal, just in case you can't get all of your Democratic colleagues on board.
Actually, you know, I have not had to personally have the conversation with that many. They were coming to me and telling me how they were in support of this piece of legislation. So it wasn't a hard sell on the Republican side. They just see it as common sense and legislation that definitely should go forward for the city of Detroit.
Where are you hearing opposition from on that bill?
I think people who do not fully grasp the city. You know, I think that when you're having conversations with people who do not know what it's like to have a city be great and then a city completely fall apart and go in disarray and have abandoned property and people bailing and leaving the city like crazy, burnt down property, and then to have people purchase companies from out of country, purchase property, sit on it, don't do anything with it, having this wait and see attitude, people who are walking away from their homes within their own neighborhood, you know, paying up the property taxes on it, waiting to see what's going to happen in the future. You know, I don't think people really understand what that is and what it looks like and how it feels and how impactful it is on a community. I think people are basing it on where they live at and who they represent and not getting the full story on what this really looks like for us as Detroiters and has looked like and what we're trying to line our future up with.
Are you concerned that this vote that you took on the Reproductive Health Act legislation, do you think it's going to have an impact on how quickly this tax plan proposal gets moved?
Absolutely not. I do not think that the Speaker of the House is that type of person at all. I do not think that that's his type of leadership. He is not going to play games with the city of Detroit that he also represents in that manner. I do not see that within his character whatsoever.
Sort of a follow-up question. I know there's a pretty strict October deadline that Mayor Duggan has set. Do you think that's achievable at this point?
I do. I think it's achievable. I think that people just need to understand what the gravity of the situation and how impactful it really is. Not just, you know, there are just some people who will never get there. You know, they look at the suburban areas that they represent and they see that they have a lot of renters, for example. And the renters of the city of Detroit are not the same as the renters of another suburb area. Renters in Detroit normally rent in their area for 1 to 2 years and they move on to the next place. We do not have people that normally rent and stay long-term in one location. And I think people take those things into consideration and don't look at the programs that the city of Detroit offer, the things that are available for people to become homeowners. We have a lot of advancement that the mayor has put forth to move the city forward and to change the game from renters to owners, to ensure that we have more developments within the city, to make sure that we have people playing fair and taking care of the property that they have and developing that property. And I would just like to, you know, see that move forward in any way, shape, or form. We need to make that happen.
I had just one more question. It has to do with these lawsuits dealing with the redistricting maps, particularly with the city of Detroit. Have you been following that? And what's your view on the fact that there are still lawsuits that challenge the state house and the state senate map on the argument that it's not representative of, or it doesn't give enough voice to African Americans and in general, or to the city of Detroit, maybe more specifically?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think we've lost a lot of our representation and it's very sad. You know, Detroiters speak for Detroiters. And just like I represent Dearborn, initially I had 3 precincts in Dearborn. I have 40% of Dearborn now of my district. I look to representative like Alabaz Farhat to help me when it comes down to making decisions for Dearborn. I don't live in Dearborn. I live in Detroit. I've been a Detroiter all of my life. The issues are not the same. And I think that we have representatives that do not take that in consideration. They do not look to other representatives that are there for the city of Detroit who are native Detroiters. I didn't just move to my area to run for office. I've been here since I was 2 years old in the very house I grew up in. Those are the people that you talk to and you get their opinions on things. You do not take the fact that you have been a representative for these few months within a year and say now that you're an expert on the city of Detroit. I don't do that to Dearborn. I don't like it when it's done to the city of Detroit.
How do you really think this new Democratic trifecta has been performing so far? What are your honest thoughts?
My honest thoughts is that I think we've gotten a lot of good legislation done. I think we've moved a lot of things and helped move the state forward in some really grand ways. There are a lot of things that I definitely think that should have happened. You know, mental health has not been addressed. You know, we're talking about where funds can go when it comes to that. I would love to see Medicaid funds become telehealth for mental health, where people can actually get that assistance. There is public safety that has not been addressed. There are just things that definitely need to be looked at and have not had that. We do not have a mental health hospital in the city of Detroit. If I can't think of a better place to have one with everything that we have going on when it comes to public safety. So there are some things that I would like to see happen that have not happened. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get there.
Do you personally support adjourning early as a legislature as a whole for the early primary legislation to be enacted?
I don't know about supporting one way or another. I'll leave that to leadership. That's out of my wheelhouse of what would be best, because they know the long-term game plan that I'm not privy to. So I think that I'm not in a position to actually give an opinion, an educated opinion on that.
So sure. I did realize that when the statement about you know, the voting no explanation came out, it was sent through a Gmail account, not one of the office accounts. Is there a reason because of that?
I always make sure that I handle my own language when it comes to things. I steer my own ship. So I always make sure that I do that. I have never, since I've been in office, have ever counted on the caucus comms department to do my communication for me. That's something I always have handled myself. I'm the only person I trust to do that. So no, that's why.
Representative Whitsitt, is there anything else you want to highlight while you have this platform?
I want to highlight the fact that we need to think about the people who are within our Democratic Party across the United States, not just here in Michigan, that are also moderates. And we do represent a large group of people who do not think as everyone else does. You know, there are a lot of things that are progressive, and, you know, I'm in support of that, but I'm also in support of making sure that we do things also in moderation, and we do them smartly, effectively, efficiently, and affordably. And that's something that I want to see put forward. And I think that's being lost right now in the conversation.
Representative Karen Whitsitt, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Step further. We are shaken, torn, and tattered. I'm swaying from it all. Are we really so stupid?
And we are now joined by CMU President Rob Davies. Fire up, President Davies.
Absolutely. Fire up, Chips. It's great to see you again. I'm glad you're doing very, very well.
Thank you. And then obviously we do have Daniel Hurley, the Chief Executive Officer of the Michigan Association of State Universities, to discuss the Michigan Assured Admission Pact, the MAAP. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I am great. Glad to be with you today.
So to my understanding, and of course, Dan, you can correct me on all of this, this will be a pact of multiple public universities in Michigan, including CMU, Eastern Michigan University, Northern Michigan, Wayne State, and the University of Michigan's in Flint and Dearborn, where ultimately, if you're accepted into one with a 3.0 GPA or higher, you'd be accepted into all. Am I understanding this correctly, Dan?
Yes, you are. It is that simple. It is a pact, not so much a policy. It is the simple message we're trying to convey to the several tens of thousands of high school seniors in Michigan that at this moment are contemplating what comes next after June next spring. And yeah, we want to, you know, just send the message among these 10 participating public universities that if you achieve that one metric, a minimum 3.0 on a 4.0 scale, you will be assured admission to these universities. And I think the overarching aim is to help like demystify the process. We know applying for college can be anxiety producing for both students and parents. And, you know, there's a lot to a young adult's life in terms of his or her portfolio, athletics, extracurricular activities, SAT scores, all of that. It helps. It matters. But ultimately, these 10 universities said, you know what? It's the best predictor of accomplishments, experience, ability to succeed in college is those 3 or 4 years of high school and the grades you achieve in that curriculum. So that's the overarching simple message and part of the pact. And we think it's going to really help out this year's cohort of students.
So just to confirm, is all I need is the 3.0 GPA, or are there still some things that could maybe not look as good for me on a college application?
So there are some universities that may continue to use their, if there are issues with like disciplinary issues, you know, criminal issues and the felonies and stuff like that, I think that would be a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the student population. And then even less impactful is universities requiring, for obvious reasons, English proficiency. So there may be some international students that came to Michigan, graduated from a public high school or a high school, and then are applying to college. But I cannot foresee a student successfully graduating from high school and not being highly proficient in English.
Will there be a new application portal for this, or would I, so, and I guess I'm not speaking for myself, I'm using an example general person, but, you know, would somebody, you know, apply with a specific new portal, or would they apply to one university and then somehow get accepted to all? How exactly does the application process change because of this?
It's very simple. There is not one portal. It is simply students that are interested in applying to any of these universities go through the regular process of applying to those to that university of choice or maybe additional ones. And once they make that application, there's a strong line of communication between the institution and the applicant. But really, the message that these universities are sending with this pact is that if you have that 3.0, you are assured admission. And just that alone should take a lot of stress out of the process. But on the flip side, really, I think, be much more motivating and exciting for students that, again, especially the seniors right now, they're pondering what comes next. And President Davies can speak to this. I think we all can. But it's not just a cliche that now is probably the best time in a long, long time to enroll in college and earn a four-year degree for so many different reasons.
President Davies, how did you find out about the development of this PAC proposal, and how did you get on board?
Well, we were, thank you very much, and thank you for hosting this. And I just want to echo some of the comments that Dan made earlier. This is a great opportunity for students in high school to explore, to realize that they have the opportunity. When I get a chance to talk to the many students who apply to CMU or are even thinking about it, there's usually someone supporting them. There's usually someone saying that you have the ability, you have the great point of average, you have the opportunity to go to a university. There's a lot of individuals who don't get that extra push. And so they're always wondering, am I good enough to get into Central Michigan University? With this pact, and I'll talk a little bit about what you asked in a second, with this pact, we are saying to first-generation students, we're saying to students in the rural communities, we're saying to students throughout the entire state, if you have a 3.0, there's no more guesswork. You will be accepted to Central Michigan University. We believe in you because of what you've achieved, that you will have a high probability of success here at CMU. The way we found out about it was through the good work of the Michigan Association of State Universities, MASU, which Dan is the executive director of and leads. And he was the one that brought it to our attention and said, this is a program that we're working on. Would you be interested? And we looked at our portfolio of students who come to us. We looked at who's successful. We looked at our entrance requirements and those type of things. And we said, we can support a student coming in with a 3.0. So it was a very easy decision for us. I also want to be very clear about this. We are not lowering our admission standards. We are not doing something just to grab students and, you know, without having a high probability of success. I've charged our admissions team that when, and it's not a secret that CMU is dealing with admissions challenges. We're not going to lower standards. We're not just going to open the doors and let the floodgates come in. Because when we admit a student, we are taking a charge and saying that we believe you can be successful. You have to do the work, you have to do all these different types of things, but we believe you can be successful.
No.
And so with this pack, we're able to guarantee or have that high feeling that they can be successful, and we look forward to welcoming them to CMU.
Is there a concern, though, about competition within the pact? Does this put these universities in direct competition with one another? Because maybe someone gets accepted into CMU, and then they say, wait, maybe I should go to Wayne State where I can live in the city of Detroit. What is the concern about that?
I would answer that in a very interesting way. The American Higher Education University is built on many ways. The American higher education system, and it's a very loose system, is based on competition. We compete with all universities for resources. We compete with universities for students. We would compete with universities for state appropriations, for grants and contracts and everything else along the lines. One of the neat things about American higher education, it's based on competition. It's also based on collaboration, which makes us a little different than many other industries, because we do realize that we serve a public good. We serve a public good in that we want all students to have those opportunities. So yes, when students come to Central Michigan University and get accepted, they are also applying to other universities. They're applying to other universities within the PAC and also with ones without of the PAC. What this does for us, I believe, is it sends a very clear message to students who are on the fence about applying to any university. And then all of a sudden, this gives them that motivation of, okay, I've got that 3.0. I don't have to worry about getting rejected, because that's hard. And so they will put in an application to CMU, and they may put it into another one. When they come on our campus, they're going to see why the value of CMU is so high. The commitment that we have to students, the low classes, the personal connections with faculty, the success rate of our students, 94% of our students on day of graduation have a job or graduate school in hand. We lead, the state and among the top in the state in that area. You're proof of that. And so we believe by expanding that opportunities, we will be fine.
Now, CMU is a place where enrollment has dropped by more than 43% in the last 8 years, after it reached an all-time peak of more than 25,500 students in 2015. And summer 2015 was when I applied for CMU. Mm-hmm. Why do you think Mount Pleasant became a less attractive place for people to go to school? What was its Achilles heel in all of this?
I think there's a lot of things that were going on at that particular time. Some of the things that you just mentioned, or I just talked about, competition and things along those lines. And those are the things that we've addressed. I'm very proud to say that over the last 2 years, we've had larger freshman classes, larger transfer classes, larger graduate school classes coming into Central Michigan University. We've actually turned it around. And again, when we turned it around, we did not do this by lowering standards. We talked about what makes Central Michigan University special. It's that sense of community. It is the connection that we have with faculty, staff, and students that really create a community that lifts one another up. I'm sure that you experienced that as you were a student here. Each of our students get a hands-on experience. They're going to do research with a faculty member. Our faculty members are the individuals that they get to meet their very first year as a freshman. At many universities, they won't meet the students won't meet their faculty members, the tenure track, until their senior year. They will do that at the first time. We also have a very key element where we combine the real world with the classrooms through internships and externships. And you said it earlier, we have a fired up attitude. We take on challenges and overcome obstacles. That culture is what makes CMU special, and that's what we focused in on, and that's why we are seeing that turnaround that we're seeing today.
I mean, I wonder, Dan, if you can speak on this. I mean, when people ask you about declining university enrollment, because obviously it's not just CMU, there's other places, what is the Achilles heel here? What is the biggest issue?
It's actually a rather simple one called demographics. And Michigan is not alone. The entire Midwest and Northeast United States. I have a growing population and a migrating population to the South and Southwest. But I will say, I think despite the fact that the forecast suggests we will have a continuing declining high school graduation or high school graduate population for about another 8 years or so. But I think we are turning the corner and are gonna stay turned given the new Michigan Achievement Scholarship. And if I may, I'd like to speak a little bit about that, because this is a huge win, feather in the cap, tip of the hat to our state lawmakers. Last year, bipartisan fashion, Republicans, Democrats, House, Senate, the governor all came together and passed this huge new scholarship program, Michigan Achievement Scholarship, for the public university sector. It represents a $5,500 a year scholarship for up to 5 years. For individuals, again, enrolling in the public universities. It started with this past spring's high school class. That and the state forecasts originally were that upwards of 75% of students would be eligible for this award. That's huge. So it's really reaching well into the middle class. That $5,500 is the equivalent of 35 to 45% of tuition costs at, for example, the 10 universities participating in the Michigan Assured Admission Pact. So that's one third to almost one half discount off of tuition for all 10 of these universities. And so when you look at that huge increase almost overnight in college affordability, this is why I think, and then you have, like, for example, the messaging around this Michigan Assured Admission Pact, I think we're going to see, I'm really optimistic about what comes forward. President Davies shared some metrics from CMU. We don't have, our association coordinates an annual enrollment report. It'll be out probably third week or so of October. But just based on institutional communications and media accounts, we're seeing some really bright spots all around the state, big schools, small schools, rural, urban, especially around that incoming freshman class. And I think a lot of it has to do with the Achievement Scholarship. There was very little marketing visibility around this Achievement Scholarship in the past year, the first year. The state has come through again with significant dollars to market the program. And I think that come next April, May, June, when students are making a decision, they'll be much more informed around about this new significant program. You know, high school counselors will be, families, et cetera. So I just think there's going to be a much more significant take-up rate, utilization rate of the scholarship. Hopefully this new Michigan Assured Admission Pact will play a role as well. But I think, you know, there will always see variation, but I would not be surprised if all 15 public universities next year see an enrollment increase, a modest one. And I think that will continue for the next few years. It's hard to turn the dial on post-secondary participation rate, but I think we're really all rowing in the same direction here in Michigan, and I think we're going to get it done here in the next several years.
And what is this pact modeled after? Are there other states that have a similar pact?
There is. The one that we caught our attention was actually, it's an association like ours. There's only five other states that have an association voluntary where all of the public universities participate. And in our case, it was the Washington State Council of Presidents representing Washington State, University of Washington, and a handful of regionals. And we met with them virtually and had some of their staff meet with the campus admissions directors. And that was a while ago. And so this is not an overnight initiative. A huge credit to the admissions directors at the universities who really thought through this carefully. There's a lot of dynamics at play. But when you, for example, look at the website, maap.org, it is very simple, you know, in terms of what this new pact represents and what the next step is students should take when looking at opportunities for enrolling at one of these institutions.
You know, this would be a question I would have both for you, Dan, and President Davies, is the remaining impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and what it did for higher education learning. I personally graduated from CMU during the pandemic, November 2020, where I wonder if there was a lot of young people that realized I could take classes online at my own time, my own pace, for a much smaller cost than going to a traditional four-year university. Has that been a huge impact on you all as you recover enrollment?
I think that there is the lasting impact of COVID. And I do not think that the students are, especially the traditional age students coming out of high school, are making that decision between online or in person. There is some of that. We are seeing several of our students, first time at any college, take solely online and not come to campus. But that's a very, very small number. I think a lot of other individuals are making the decision, do I take a gap year and wait a year or two before I go to a university? Or they're deciding to not go to a university whatsoever. And to me, I think that one of the things that we're pointing out is the benefits both for their personal side as well for the public side of why it is a much wiser decision to get into a four-year institution sooner rather than later. We talk about the earnings, we talk about the opportunities to grow, we talk about the benefits of salaries. We also just talk about the long-term benefits as well to the communities that they will end up serving.
I would just add kind of thematically, the just incredibly rich experience living, working, learning on a public university campus. The classroom is just the start. It's the hundreds of student organizations, It's the guest speakers from all around the nation and world that come in and speak. It's the ethnic and racial socioeconomic diversity. It's just very rich. Arts and entertainment, athletics, I mean, on and on and on. It is a comprehensive, holistic experience. And I think that that will always be there. It's handy to have online instruction and, you know, that opportunity. I think CMU, you've taken a lead in a lot of that for, you know, years and years. But I think going forward, it'll be, there'll always be a hybrid aspect. But I think, you know, the farther we get away from COVID and the pandemic, the more I think we'll get reacclimated to just how valuable and rich of an experience it is to live and spend, especially your undergraduate years on campus.
One of the trends that we're seeing is actually very interesting is more and more of our on-campus students, fully on-campus students, are taking online courses. In 2015, when you were here, that was probably around 25-30%. It's upwards of 80-90% now. And it's that experiences that are outside the classroom that brings them to Mount Pleasant to have that experience, but also the flexibility of the online program. But even with that, they're still taking, and many of them are still taking in-person classes as well.
But President Davies, I do just have to poke your mind one more time at this question, sure. Because obviously you're talking to students and I'm sure you ask them, you know, why didn't your friends want to come with you? Why didn't your neighbors want to come with you? What does the everyday student who you talk to respond with?
Oh, it's very interesting. It kind of varies. We are in the center of Michigan. We survey students. I do obviously talk to students about on campus, why they're here. Many of them will say, it was far enough away from home. I have many other ones that say it was close enough to home. I have some people say that I love this, the bigness of this campus. I have our bigness of the largeness of Mount Pleasant, believe it or not. I have other students that say it was just small enough for me. And so it's a really, we're in this middle area that is very, very interesting. Also, when we survey students who decided to go to a different university, again, similar things come about. It was too close or too far. It was too big or too small. Very rarely do we get lack of academic programs or anything along those lines. It's more about a personal fit that they may have.
Now, Dan, I do want to change the conversation away from the pact and start to ask about some legislation that's been introduced by Senator Ed McBroom. I know he's introduced this before. A resolution seeking to subject all the university boards to the state's Open Meetings Act. Could you kind of talk about this latest round of this legislation being introduced?
Yeah, we appreciate the good senator's work. He's been an ally on many, many issues in the past. It's really the same refrain for us, and that is that the governing boards of the state universities of Michigan do already meet in public. They have formal sessions that are always open to the public. They're posted ahead of time. They're available for viewing online. People can come and attend in person. There are, however, non-formal sessions where the university boards do need to consult on sensitive matters. And those are not always open to public purview, nor should they be. But when it comes to those public sessions, they are open. And there's always, of course, a public comment period where individuals, members of the public, various stakeholders can come in and weigh in.
But obviously right now there are concerns about transparency, especially related to the sexual harassment headlines surrounding MSU right now. And I'm not going to go into details with that. But parents and students are upset about transparency at public universities. Is there any way to find some sort of middle ground here?
I think there is. If the universities were to elaborate all the ways that they provide transparency, every university, for example, it's actually a state mandate, has a transparency icon on their main website. You click that, you're going to have access to a remarkable amount of data that will help inform the whole landscape of that institution. The Freedom of Information Act, FOIAs. A lot of folks around Michigan, the nation, the world were a little surprised a couple of Sundays ago with what, you know, appeared in USA Today. Well, that's part of the transparency apparatus that operates here in Michigan. So there is an ample number of vehicles right now for transparency, communications, and reporting.
And as we continue to move forward with this legislative term that's going to go until next year, is there anything else that public universities are seeking from the legislature at this point in time?
So I would say the word that comes to mind, and I haven't said this for the decades I've been working on behalf of the public universities in Michigan, but it's optimism. I'm really optimistic on everything I've seen here in the last couple of years. Credit to the legislature and the governor, and momentum. Let's keep the momentum up. And a lot of it has to do with state funding, institutional support provided in many ways, significant new financial support to students. I mean, I think that's job one. We've made a huge turnaround and reinvestment in our state universities and the students they serve. Big impact on college affordability. I think for my role, that's job one. And when it comes to public policy, there is more that can be done. You know, for example, I think one of the priorities is ways that we can incentivize our K-12 partners and students and families to do a better job in completing the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA. And so I think we'll be working with our friends in the legislature and in the executive branch to see what progress we can be made there to turn the dial up on FAFSA completion. Because again, it's not just a bureaucratic exercise. There's a lot of dollars available at the state level and the federal level that can really positively impact college affordability for students.
So Dan, would your association support the legislation right now to make FAFSA filing a graduation requirement for high schoolers?
Short answer is yes, but with a big asterisk, and that is, and there is legislation out there. We are very familiar with it, but I would just have to very much reiterate, there is a huge set of opt-out provisions. If this legislation were enacted, there absolutely would not be any high school student in this state that wouldn't graduate because they didn't fill out the FAFSA. And so this is a partnership, huge partnership between Michigan's colleges, universities, and high schools in particular. The colleges are doing a lot hand in hand, CMU, credit to you, in the communities, working with students, families, counselors, helping students get those FAFSAs completed. We're gonna continue that work. So it's not, you know, the higher ed sector saying, K-12, get this done. It's a collaboration. And I do think that the more we discuss this legislation, our friends in K-12 and in the legislature will be supportive of joining several other states. I spoke to my counterparts in two states today, Indiana, Illinois, where they have adopted a universal FAFSA, and it's working quite well.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I just want to give a huge thanks to Daniel Hurley, the Chief Executive Officer of the Michigan Association of State Universities, and of course, CMU President Rob Davies. Thank you all so much for your time today on the MERS Monday podcast.
And we got to say it.
Fire up chips.
Have a great day.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, Michael Stroud, currently of Republican Nikki Snyder's U.S. Senate campaign, and former Michigan Conservative Union President Thomas Norton. Additionally, thank you to State Rep Karen Whitsitt of Detroit, CEO Dan Hurley of the Michigan Association of State Universities, and Central Michigan University President Robert Davies. And as always, I'd love to give a tremendous thanks to MERS editor Kyle Malin and our House reporter Danielle James. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore, Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Shriver.